Chapter 14. Merging Brains and Machines. There are two widely discussed proposals for how humans could combine brains and computers to prevent our death and extinction. One is uploading our brains into computers, and the other is merging our brains with computers. These proposals have been staples of science fiction and futurists for decades, but recently, scientists and technologists have been taking them more seriously, and some people are working to make them a reality. In this chapter, I will explore these two proposals in light of what we have learned about brains. Uploading your brain entails recording all the details of your brain and then using them to simulate your brain on a computer. The simulator would be identical to your brain, so you would then live in the computer. The goal is to separate your mental and intellectual you from your biological body. This way, you can live indefinitely, including in a computer that is remote from Earth. You wouldn't die if Earth became uninhabitable. Merging your brain with a computer entails connecting the neurons in your brain to the silicon chips in a computer. This would, for example, allow you to access all the resources of the internet just by thinking. One goal of this is to give you superhuman powers. Another is to mitigate the negative effects of an intelligence explosion, which, as I discussed in Chapter 11, is if intelligent machines suddenly get so smart that we can't control them, and then they kill or subjugate us. By merging our brains with computers, we also become super intelligent and are not left behind. We save ourselves by merging with the machines. These ideas may strike you as ridiculous, outside the realm of possibility, but plenty of smart people take them seriously. It is easy to understand why they are appealing. Uploading your brain allows you to live forever, and merging your brain gives you superhuman abilities. Will these proposals come to fruition, and will they mitigate the existential risks we face? I am not optimistic. Why we feel trapped in our body. At times, I feel as if I am trapped in my body, as if my conscious intellect could exist in another form. Therefore, just because my body gets old and dies, why must I die? If I wasn't stuck in a biological body, couldn't I live forever? Death is odd. On the one hand, our old brain is programmed to fear it, yet our bodies are programmed to die. Why would evolution make us fear the one thing that is most inevitable? Evolution settled on this conflicted strategy, presumably for a good reason. My best guess is again based on the idea proposed by Richard Dawkins in his book, The Selfish Gene. Dawkins argues that evolution is not about the survival of species, but about the survival of individual genes. From a gene's perspective, we need to live long enough to have children, that is, to make copies of the gene. Living much longer than that, although good for an individual animal, might not be in the best interest of an individual gene. For example, you and I are a particular combination of genes. After we have children, it might be better from a gene's perspective to make room for new combinations, new people. In a world with limited resources, it is better for a gene to exist in many different combinations with other genes. So that's why we are programmed to die, to make room for other combinations, but only after we have had offspring. The implication of Dawkins's theory is that we are unwitting servants to genes. Complex animals, such as ourselves, exist solely to help genes replicate. It is all about the gene. Recently, something new has happened. Our species became intelligent. This, of course, helps us make more copies of our genes. Our intelligence lets us better avoid predators, find food, and live in varied ecosystems. But our emergent intelligence has had a consequence that is not necessarily in the best interest of genes. For the first time in the history of life on Earth, we understand what is going on. We have become enlightened. Our neocortex contains a model of evolution and a model of the universe, and now it understands the truth underlying our existence. Because of our knowledge and intelligence, we can consider acting in ways that are not in the best interest of genes, such as using birth control or modifying genes that we don't like. I see the current human situation as a battle between two powerful forces. In one corner, we have genes and evolution, which have dominated life for billions of years. Genes don't care about the survival of individuals. They don't care about the survival of our society. Most don't even care if our species goes extinct, because genes typically exist in multiple species. Genes only care about making copies of themselves. Of course, genes are just molecules and don't care about anything. But it's useful to refer to them in anthropomorphic terms. In the other corner, competing with our genes, is our newly emerged intelligence. The mental I that exists in our brains wants to break free from its genetic servitude, to no longer be held captive by the Darwinian processes that got us all here. We, as intelligent individuals, want to live forever and to preserve our society. We want to escape from the evolutionary forces that created us. Uploading your brain. Uploading the brain into a computer is one means of escape. It would allow us to avoid the messiness of biology and live forever as a computer-simulated version of our former self. I wouldn't call brain uploading a mainstream idea, but it has been around for a long time, and many people find it enticing. Today, we don't have the knowledge or technology needed to upload a brain, but could we in the future? From a theoretical point of view, I don't see why not. However, it is so technically difficult that we may never be able to do it. But regardless of whether it is technically feasible, I don't think it would be satisfactory. That is, even if you could upload your brain into a computer, I don't think you would like the result. First, let's discuss the feasibility of uploading our brains. The basic idea is that we make a map of every neuron and every synapse and then recreate all of this structure in software. The computer then simulates your brain, and when it does, it will feel like you. You will be alive, but you will be in a computer brain instead of your old biological brain. How much of your brain do we need to upload in order to upload you? The neocortex is obviously needed because it is the organ of thought and intelligence. Many of our day-to-day memories are formed in the hippocampal complex, so we need that too. What about all the emotional centers of the old brain? What about the brainstem and spinal cord? Our computer body wouldn't have lungs or a heart, so do we need to upload the parts of the brain that control them? Should we allow our uploaded brain to feel pain? You might think, of course not. We only want the good stuff. But all the parts of our brain are interconnected in complex ways. If we didn't include everything, then the uploaded brain would have serious problems. Recall how a person can feel debilitating pain in a phantom limb. Pain that results from a single missing limb. If we upload the neocortex, then it would have representations of every part of your body. If the body wasn't there, you might have severe pain everywhere. Similar problems would exist for every other part of the brain. If something is left out, then the other parts of the brain would be confused and not work properly. The fact is, if we want to upload you, and we want the uploaded brain to be normal, then we have to upload the entire brain. Everything. What about your body? You might think, I don't need a body. As long as I can think and discuss ideas with other people, I will be happy. But your biological brain is designed to speak using your lungs and larynx, with their particular musculature. And your biological brain learned to see with your eyes, with their particular arrangement of photoreceptors. If your simulated brain is going to pick up thinking where your biological brain left off, then we need to recreate your eyes, eye muscles, retinas, etc. Of course, the uploaded brain doesn't need a physical body or physical eyes. A simulation should be sufficient. But it means that we would have to simulate your particular body and sensory organs. The brain and body are intimately wired together and in many ways are a singular system. We can't eliminate parts of the brain or parts of the body without seriously messing something up. None of this is a fundamental roadblock. It just means that it is far more difficult to upload you into a computer than most people imagine. The next question we have to answer is how to read the details of your biological brain. How can we detect and measure everything in sufficient detail to recreate you in a computer? The human brain has about 100 billion neurons and several hundred trillion synapses. Each neuron and synapse has a complex shape and internal structure. To recreate the brain in a computer, we have to take a snapshot that contains the location and structure of every neuron and every synapse. Today, we don't have the technology to do this in a dead brain, let alone a living one. Just the volume of data required to represent a brain greatly exceeds the capacity of our current computer systems. Obtaining the details needed to recreate you in a computer is so difficult that we might never be able to do it. But let's put all these concerns aside. Let's say that sometime in the future we have the ability to instantaneously read out everything we need to recreate you in a computer. Let's assume we have computers with sufficient power to simulate you and your body. If we could do this, I have no doubts that the computer-based brain would be aware and conscious just like you. But would you want this? Perhaps you are imagining one of the following scenarios. You are at the end of your life. The doctor says you have just hours to live. At that moment, you flip a switch. Your mind goes blank. A few minutes later, you wake up and find yourself living in a new computer-based body. Your memories are intact. You feel healthy again, and you begin your new eternal life. You shout, "Yay! I'm alive!" Now, imagine a slightly different scenario. Let's say we have the technology to read out your biological brain without affecting it. Now, when you flip the switch, your brain is copied to a computer, but you feel nothing. Moments later, the computer says, "Yay, I'm alive!" But you, the biological you, are still here too. There are two of you now, one in a biological body and one in a computer body. The computer you says, "Now that I'm uploaded, I don't need my old body, so please dispose of it." The biological you says, "Wait a second, I'm still here. I don't feel any different, and I don't want to die." What should we do about this? Maybe the solution to this dilemma is just to let the biological you live out the rest of its life and die of natural causes. That seems fair. However, until that happens, there are two of you. The biological you and the computer you have different experiences. So as time progresses, they grow apart and develop into different people. For example, the biological you and the computer you might develop different moral and political positions. Biological you might regret creating computer you. Computer you might dislike having some old bio person claiming to be it. Making matters worse, there would likely be pressure to upload your brain early in your life. For example, imagine that the intellectual health of computer you depends on the intellectual health of biological you at the time of upload. Therefore, to maximize the quality of life of your immortal copy, you should upload your brain when you are at maximum mental health, say at age 35. Another reason you might want to upload your brain early in life is that every day you live in a biological body is a day that you might die by accident, and therefore lose the opportunity for immortality. So, you decide to upload yourself at age 35. Ask yourself, would you, biological you, at 35 years old feel comfortable killing yourself after making a copy of your brain? Would you, biological you, even feel that you had achieved immortality as your computer copy went off on its own life, and you slowly aged and died? I don't think so. Uploading your brain is a misleading phrase. What you have really done is split yourself into two people. Now imagine that you upload your brain, and then the computer you immediately makes three copies of itself. There are now four computer yous and one biological you. The five of you start having different experiences and drift apart. Each will be independently conscious. Have you become immortal? Which of the four computer yous is your immortal you? As the biological you slowly ages, moving toward death, it watches the four computer yous go off to live their separate lives. There is no communal you, just five individuals. They may have started with the same brain and memories, but they immediately become separate beings, and thereafter live separate lives. Perhaps you have noticed that these scenarios are just like having children. The big difference, of course, is that you don't upload your brain into your children's heads at birth. In some ways, we try to do this. We tell our children about their family history, and we train them to share our ethics and beliefs. In that way, we transfer some of our knowledge into our children's brains. But as they grow older, they have their own experiences and become separate people, just like an uploaded brain would do. Imagine if you could upload your brain into your children. Would you want to do it? If you did, I believe you would regret it. Your children would be saddled with memories of your past and would spend their lives trying to forget all the things you did. Uploading your brain at first sounds like a great idea. Who wouldn't want to live forever? But making a copy of ourselves by uploading our brain into a computer will not achieve immortality any more than having children will. Copying yourself is a fork in the road, not an extension of it. Two sentient beings continue after the fork, not one. Once you realize this, then the appeal of uploading your brain begins to fade. Merging your brain with a computer. An alternative to uploading your brain is to merge it with a computer. In this scenario, electrodes are placed in your brain that are then connected to a computer. Now your brain can directly receive information from the computer, and the computer can directly receive information from your brain. There are good reasons to connect brains to computers. For example, spinal cord injuries can leave people with little or no ability to move. By implanting electrodes into the injured person's brain, the person can learn to control a robot arm or a computer mouse by thinking. Significant progress has already been achieved in this type of brain-controlled prosthetic, and it promises to improve the lives of many people. It does not take many connections from the brain to control a robot arm. For example, a few hundred or even a few dozen electrodes from the brain to a computer can be sufficient to control basic movements of a limb. But some people dream of a deeper, more fully connected brain-machine interface. One where there are millions, perhaps billions, of connections going both ways. They hope this will give us amazing new abilities, such as accessing all the information on the internet as simply as we access our own memories. We could perform super-fast calculations and data searches. We would thus radically enhance our mental abilities, merging brain with machine. Similar to the upload your brain scenario, there are extreme technical challenges that have to be overcome to merge with a computer. These include how to implant millions of electrodes into a brain with minimal surgery, how to avoid rejections of the electrodes by our biological tissue, and how to reliably target millions of individual neurons. There are currently teams of engineers and scientists working on these problems. Once again, I don't want to focus on the technical challenges as much as the motivations and results. So let's assume we can solve the technical problems. Why would we want to do this? Again, brain-computer interfaces make a lot of sense to help people with injuries, but why would we do this for healthy people? As I mentioned, one prominent argument for merging your brain with a computer is to counter the threat of super-intelligent AIs. Recall the intelligence explosion threat, where intelligent machines rapidly surpass us. I argued earlier that the intelligence explosion will not happen and is not an existential threat, but there are plenty of people who believe otherwise. They hope that by merging our brains with super-intelligent computers, we would become super-intelligent as well, and thus avoid being left behind. We are definitely entering science fiction territory, but is it nonsense? I don't dismiss the idea of brain-computer interfaces for brain enhancement. The basic science needs to be pursued to restore movement to the injured. Along the way, we might discover other uses for the resulting technology. For example, imagine we develop a way to precisely stimulate millions of individual neurons in the neocortex. Perhaps we do this by labeling individual neurons with barcode-like DNA snippets introduced via a virus. This kind of technology exists today. Then we activate these neurons using radio waves that are addressed to an individual's cell code. This technology does not exist, but it isn't out of the realm of possibility. Now we have a way of precisely controlling millions of neurons without surgery or implants. This could be used to restore sight to someone whose eyes don't function, or to create a new type of sensor, such as allowing someone to see using ultraviolet light. I doubt that we will ever completely merge our brain with a computer, but gaining new abilities is within the realm of likely advances. In my opinion, the uploading your brain proposal offers few benefits and is so difficult that it is unlikely to ever happen. The merging your brain with a computer proposal will likely be achieved for limited purposes, but not to the point of fully uniting brain and machine. And a brain merged with a computer still has a biological brain and body that will decay and die. Importantly, neither proposal addresses the existential risks facing humanity. If our species cannot live forever, are there things we can do today that would make our present existence meaningful, even when we are gone? Chapter 15. Estate Planning for Humanity. Up until now, I have been discussing intelligence in both biological and machine form. From here on, I want to shift the focus to knowledge. Knowledge is just the name for what we have learned about the world. Your knowledge is the model of the world that resides in your neocortex. Humanity's knowledge is the sum of what we have learned individually. In this and in the final chapter, I explore the idea that knowledge is worthy of preservation and propagation, even if that means doing so independently of humans. I often think about dinosaurs. Dinosaurs lived on Earth for about 160 million years. They fought for food and territory, and they struggled not to be eaten. Like us, they cared for their young and tried to protect their offspring from predators. They lived for tens of millions of generations. And now they are gone. What were their countless lives for? Did their one-time existence serve any purpose? Some dinosaur species evolved into today's birds, but most went extinct. If humans had not discovered dinosaur remains, then it is likely that nothing in the universe would ever know that dinosaurs existed. Humans could suffer a similar fate. If our species becomes extinct, will anyone know that we once existed, that we once lived here on Earth? If no one finds our remains, then everything we have accomplished, our science, our arts, our culture, our history, would be lost forever. And being lost forever is the same as never existing. I find this possibility a bit unsatisfactory. Of course, there are many ways that our individual lives can have meaning and purpose in the short term, in the here and now. We improve our communities, we raise and educate our children, we create works of art and enjoy nature. These types of activities can lead to a happy and fulfilling life, but these are personal and ephemeral benefits. They are meaningful to us while we and our loved ones are here, but any meaning or purpose diminishes over time, and it vanishes completely if our entire species goes extinct and no records remain. It is almost a certainty that we, Homo sapiens, will become extinct at some point in the future. In several billion years, the sun will die, ending life in our solar system. Before that happens, in a few hundred million to a billion years, the sun will get hotter and greatly expand in size, making Earth a barren oven. These events are so far off that we don't need to worry about them now, but a much earlier extinction is possible. For example, the Earth could be hit by a large asteroid, unlikely in the short term, but it could happen at any time. The most likely extinction risks we face in the short term, say the next 100 or 1,000 years, are threats that we create. Many of our most powerful technologies have existed for only about 100 years, and in that time, we have created two existential threats: nuclear weapons and climate change. We will almost certainly create new threats as our technology advances. For example, we have recently learned how to precisely modify DNA. We might create new strains of viruses or bacteria that could literally kill every human. No one knows what will happen, but it is unlikely that we are done creating ways to destroy ourselves. Of course, we need to do everything we can to mitigate these risks, and I am generally optimistic that we can prevent killing ourselves anytime soon. But I think it is a good idea to discuss what we can do now, just in case things don't work out so well. Estate planning is something you do during your life that benefits the future, not yourself. Many people don't bother to do estate planning because they think there is nothing in it for them. But that isn't necessarily true. People who create estate plans often feel it provides a sense of purpose or creates a legacy. Plus, the process of establishing an estate plan forces you to think about life from a broad perspective. The time to do it is before you are on your deathbed, because by then you may no longer have the ability to plan and execute. The same holds true for estate planning for humanity. Now is a good time to think about the future and how we can influence it when we are no longer here. When it comes to estate planning for humanity, who might benefit? Certainly no human, because the premise is that we are gone. The beneficiaries of our planning are other intelligent beings. Only an intelligent animal or an intelligent machine can appreciate our existence, our history, and our accumulated knowledge. I see two broad classes of future beings to think about. If humans go extinct but other life continues, then it is possible that intelligent animals might evolve a second time on Earth. Any second species intelligent animal would certainly be interested in knowing as much as possible about the once existing humans. We might call this the Planet of the Apes scenario, after the book and movie based on this premise. The second group we could try to reach are extraterrestrial intelligent species living elsewhere in our galaxy. The time of their existence might overlap with ours, or it might be far in the future. I will discuss both of these scenarios, although I believe that focusing on the latter is likely to be the most meaningful to us in the short term. Why might other intelligent beings care about us? What can we do now that they would appreciate after we are gone? The most important thing is to let them know that we once existed. That fact alone is valuable. Think of how much we would appreciate knowing that intelligent life existed elsewhere in our galaxy. For many people, it would completely change their outlook on life. Even if we couldn't communicate with the extraterrestrial beings, it would be of immense interest to us to know that they exist, or once existed. This is the goal of the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, SETI, a research program designed to find evidence of intelligent life in other parts of the galaxy. Beyond the fact that we once existed, we could communicate our history and our knowledge. Imagine if the dinosaurs could tell us how they lived and what led to their demise. That would be immensely interesting and, perhaps, vitally useful to us. But because we are intelligent, we can tell the future far more valuable things than the dinosaurs could tell us. We have the potential to transfer all that we have learned. We might have scientific and technological knowledge that is more advanced than what the recipient knows. Keep in mind that we are talking about what we know in the future, which will be more advanced than what we know now. Again, think of how valuable it would be to us today if we could learn, for example, whether time travel is possible, or how to make a practical fusion reactor, or just what the answers are to fundamental questions, such as whether the universe is finite or infinite. Finally, we might have the opportunity to convey what led to our demise. For example, if we today could learn that intelligent beings on distant planets went extinct due to self-induced climate change, we would take our climate situation more seriously. Knowing how long other intelligent species existed and what led to their demise would help us to survive longer. It is hard to put a value on this type of knowledge. I am going to discuss these ideas further by describing three scenarios we might use to communicate with the future. Message in a bottle. If you were stranded on a deserted island, you might write a message, put it in a bottle, and cast it into the sea. What would you write? You might put down where you are and hope that someone quickly discovers the message and rescues you, but you wouldn't have much hope that that would happen. It is more likely that your message is found long after you are gone. So, instead, you might write about who you are and how you came to be stranded on the island. Your hope would be to have your fate known and recited by someone in the future. The bottle and your message are a means of not being forgotten. The Pioneer planetary probes launched in the early 1970s have exited our solar system, passing into the Great Sea of Space. Astronomer Carl Sagan advocated for including a plaque on the Pioneer probes. The plaques show where the craft came from and include a picture of a man and a woman. Later that decade, the Voyager probes similarly included a gold record that contained sounds and images from Earth. They, too, have left the solar system. We don't expect to ever see these spacecraft again. At the rate they are traveling, it will be tens of thousands of years before they could possibly reach another star. Although the probes were not designed for the purpose of communicating with distant aliens, they are our first messages in a bottle. They are mostly symbolic, not because of the time they will take to reach a potential audience, but because they will likely never be found. Space is so large and the craft are so small that the chance they encounter anything is tiny. Still, it is comforting to know that these spacecraft exist, traveling through space right now. If our solar system blew up tomorrow, these plaques and records would be the only physical record of life on Earth. They would be our only legacy. Today, there are initiatives to send spacecraft to nearby stars. One prominent effort is called the Breakthrough Starshot. It envisions using high-powered space-based lasers to propel tiny spacecraft to our nearest neighboring star, Alpha Centauri. The primary goal of this initiative is to take pictures of the planets orbiting Alpha Centauri and beam them back to Earth. Under optimistic assumptions, the entire process would take several decades. Like the Pioneer and Voyager probes, the Starshot craft will continue to move through space long after we are gone. If the spacecraft are discovered by intelligent beings elsewhere in the galaxy, then those beings would know that we once existed and were intelligent enough to send spacecraft between the stars. Unfortunately, this is a poor way to intentionally communicate our existence to other beings. The spacecraft are tiny and slow. They can only reach a minuscule portion of our galaxy, and even if they reached an inhabited star system, the likelihood of being discovered is small. Leave the lights on. The SETI Institute has spent years trying to detect intelligent life elsewhere in our galaxy. SETI assumes that other intelligent beings are broadcasting a signal with sufficient power that we can detect it here on Earth. Our radar, radio, and TV broadcasts also send signals out into space. But these signals are so weak that we, using our existing SETI technology, couldn't detect similar signals from other planets unless they came from one very close to us. Hence, right now, there could be millions of planets with intelligent life just like ours, scattered throughout our galaxy. And if each planet had a SETI program just like ours, nobody would detect anything. They, like us, would be saying, "Where is everybody?" For SETI to be successful, we assume that intelligent beings are purposely creating strong signals designed to be detected over long distances. It is also possible that we could detect a signal not intended for us. That is, we might just happen to be aligned with a highly targeted signal and unintentionally pick up a conversation. But, for the most part, SETI assumes that an intelligent species is trying to make itself known by sending a powerful signal. It would be considerate if we did the same. This is referred to as METI, which stands for Messaging Extraterrestrial Intelligence. You might be surprised to learn that quite a few people think that METI is a bad idea, like the worst idea ever. They fear that by sending a signal into space, and thereby making our presence known, other, more advanced beings will come over to our star and kill us, enslave us, do experiments on us, or maybe accidentally infect us with a bug that we can't fight. Perhaps they are looking for planets that they can live on, and the easiest way to find one is to wait for people like us to raise our hands and say, "Over here!" In any case, humanity would be doomed. This reminds me of one of the most common errors that first-time technology entrepreneurs make. They fear someone will steal their idea, and therefore they keep it secret. In almost all cases, it is better to share your idea with anyone who might be able to help you. Other people can give you product and business advice and help you in numerous other ways. Entrepreneurs are far more likely to succeed by telling people what they are doing than by being secretive. It is human nature, aka old brain, to suspect everyone wants to steal your idea. where the reality is that you are lucky if anyone cares about your idea at all. The risk of METI is built upon a series of improbable assumptions. It assumes that other intelligent beings are capable of interstellar travel. It assumes they are willing to spend significant time and energy to make the trip to Earth. Unless the aliens are hiding someplace nearby, it might take thousands of years for them to get here. It assumes that the intelligent agents need Earth, or something on Earth, that they can't get any other way, so it is worth the trip. It assumes that despite having the technology for interstellar travel, they don't have the technology to detect life on Earth without us broadcasting our presence. And finally, it assumes that such an advanced civilization would be willing to cause us harm, as opposed to trying to help us, or at least not hurt us. Regarding this last point, it is a reasonable assumption that intelligent beings elsewhere in the galaxy evolved from non-intelligent life, just as we did. Therefore, the aliens probably faced the same types of existential risks that we face today. To survive long enough to become a galaxy-faring species means that they somehow got past these risks. Therefore, it is likely that whatever brain equivalent they have now would no longer be dominated by false beliefs or dangerously aggressive behavior. There is no guarantee that this would happen, but it makes it less likely that they would harm us. For all the aforementioned reasons, I believe we have nothing to fear from METI. Like a new entrepreneur, we will be better off trying to tell the world that we exist and hope that someone, anyone, cares. The best way to approach both SETI and METI is critically dependent on how long intelligent life typically survives. It is possible that intelligence has arisen millions of times in our galaxy, and almost none of the intelligent beings existed at the same time. Here is an analogy. Imagine 50 people are invited to an evening party. Everyone arrives at the party at a randomly chosen time. When they get there, they open the door and step inside. What are the chances they see a party going on or an empty room? It depends on how long they each stay. If all the partygoers stay for 1 minute before leaving, then almost everyone who shows up will see an empty room and conclude that no one else came to the party. If the partygoers stay for an hour or two, then the party will be a success, with lots of people in the room at the same time. We don't know how long intelligent life typically lasts. The Milky Way galaxy is about 13 billion years old. Let's say that it has been able to support intelligent life for about 10 billion years. That is the length of our party. If we assume that humans survive as a technological species for 10,000 years, then it is as if we showed up for a 6-hour party but only stayed for 1/50th of a second. Even if tens of thousands of other intelligent beings show up for the same party, it is likely that we won't see anyone else while we are there. We will see an empty room. If we expect to discover intelligent life in our galaxy, it requires that intelligent life occurs often and that it lasts a long time. I expect that extraterrestrial life is common. It is estimated there are about 40 billion planets in the Milky Way alone that could support life, and life appeared on Earth billions of years ago, soon after the planet was formed. If Earth is typical, then life will be common in our galaxy. I also believe that many planets with life will eventually evolve intelligent life. I have proposed that intelligence is based on brain mechanisms that first evolved for moving our bodies and recognizing places we have been. So intelligence may not be too remarkable once there are multicellular animals moving about. However, we are interested in intelligent life that understands physics and that possesses the advanced technologies needed to send and receive signals from space. On Earth, this happened only once, and only recently. We just don't have enough data to know how common species like us are. My guess is that technological species occur more often than you might conclude if you just looked at the history of Earth. I am surprised by how long it took for advanced technologies to appear on our planet. For example, I see no reason why technologically advanced species couldn't have appeared 100 million years ago when dinosaurs roamed the Earth. Regardless of how common technologically advanced life is, it might not last a long time. Technologically advanced species elsewhere in the galaxy will likely experience problems similar to those we face. The history of failed civilizations on Earth, plus the existential threats we are creating, suggests that advanced civilizations may not last very long. Of course, it is possible that species like ours could figure out how to survive for millions of years, but I don't consider it likely. The implications of this is that intelligent and technologically advanced life might have sprung up millions of times in the Milky Way. But when we look out at the stars, we won't find intelligent life waiting to have a conversation with us. Instead, we will see stars where intelligent life once existed, but not now. The answer to the question, where is everybody, is that they already left the party. There is a way to get around all these issues. There is a way to discover intelligent life in our galaxy, and perhaps even in other galaxies. Imagine that we create a signal that indicates we were here on Earth. The signal needs to be strong enough to be detected from far away, and it needs to last a long time. The signal needs to persist long after we are gone. Creating such a signal is like leaving a calling card at the party that says, "We were here." People who show up later won't find us, but they will know that we once existed. This suggests a different way to think about SETI and METI. Specifically, it suggests we should first focus our efforts on how we could create a long-lasting signal. By long-lasting, I mean 100,000 years, or maybe millions of years, or even a billion. The longer the signal persists, the more likely it will be successful. There is a nice secondary benefit to this idea. Once we figure out how to make such a signal, then we will know what to look for ourselves. Other intelligent beings will likely reach the same conclusions we do. They too will look for how to create a long-lasting signal. As soon as we figure out how to do this, then we can start looking for it. Today, SETI searches for radio signals that contain a pattern indicating that the signal was sent by an intelligent being. For example, a signal that repeated the first 20 digits of pi would certainly be created by an intelligent species. I doubt we will ever find such a signal. It presumes that intelligent beings elsewhere in our galaxy have set up a powerful radio transmitter and, using computers and electronics, placed a code in the signal. We have done this ourselves a few brief times. It requires a big antenna pointed into space, electrical energy, people, and computers. Because of the brief duration of the signals we sent, the messages were more symbolic efforts than serious attempts to reach out to the rest of our galaxy. The problem with broadcasting a signal using electricity, computers, and antennas is that the system won't run for very long. Antennas, electronics, wires, etc. will not stay functional for even 100 years without maintenance, let alone 1,000,000 years. The method we choose to signal our presence has to be powerful, broadly directed, and self-sustaining. Once started, it needs to reliably run for millions of years without any maintenance or intervention. Stars are like this. Once started, a star emits large amounts of energy for billions of years. We want to find something that is similar, but that couldn't be started without the guiding hand of an intelligent species. Astronomers have found many odd sources of energy in the universe that, for example, oscillate, rotate, or emit short bursts. Astronomers look for natural explanations for these unusual signals, and usually they find them. Perhaps some of the as-yet unexplained phenomena are not natural, but the type of signal I am talking about, created by intelligent beings. That would be nice, but I doubt it will be that easy. It is more likely that physicists and engineers will have to work on this problem for a while to come up with a set of possible methods to create a strong, self-sustaining signal that unmistakably originated with an intelligent being. The method also has to be something that we can implement. For example, physicists might conceive of a new type of energy source capable of generating such a signal. But if we don't have the ability to create it ourselves, then we should assume that other intelligent beings can't either. And we should keep looking. I have noodled on this problem for years, keeping an eye out for something that might fit the bill. Recently, a candidate surfaced. One of the most exciting areas of astronomy today is the discovery of planets orbiting other stars. Until recently, it was not known if planets were common or rare. We now know the answer. Planets are common, and most stars have multiple planets, just like ours. The primary way we know this is by detecting slight reductions in starlight as a planet passes between a distant star and our telescopes. We could use the same basic idea to signal our presence. For example, imagine if we placed into orbit a set of objects that block a bit of the sun's light in a pattern that would not occur naturally. These orbiting sun blockers would continue to orbit the sun for millions of years, long after we are gone, and they could be detected from far away. We already possess the means to build such a sun blocker system, and there may be better ways to signal our presence. Here is not the place to evaluate our options. I am merely making the following observations. 1. Intelligent life may have evolved thousands or millions of times in our galaxy, but it is unlikely that we will find ourselves coexisting with other intelligent species. 2. SETI will be unlikely to succeed if we only look for signals that require ongoing participation by the sender. 3. METI is not only safe, it is the most important thing we can do to discover intelligent life in our galaxy. We need to first determine how we can make our presence known in a way that lasts for millions of years. Only then will we know what to look for. Wiki Earth. Letting a distant civilization know that we once existed is an important first goal. But to me, the most important thing about humans is our knowledge. We are the only species on Earth that possesses knowledge of the universe and how it works. Knowledge is rare, and we should attempt to preserve it. Let's assume that humans go extinct, but life on Earth continues. For example, an asteroid is believed to have killed the dinosaurs and many other species, but some small animals managed to survive the impact. 60 million years later, some of those survivors became us. This actually happened, and it could happen again. Imagine now that we humans have gone extinct, perhaps due to a natural disaster or to something we did. Other species survive, and in 50 million years, one of them becomes intelligent. That species would definitely want to know everything they could about the long-gone human epoch. They would be particularly interested in knowing the extent of our knowledge and what happened to us. If humans go extinct, then in just a million years or so, all detailed records of our life will likely be lost. There will be buried remains of some of our cities and large infrastructure, but pretty much every document, film, and recording will no longer exist. Future non-human archaeologists will struggle to piece together our history in the same way paleontologists today struggle to figure out what happened to the dinosaurs. As part of our estate plan, we could preserve our knowledge in a more permanent form, one that could last tens of millions of years. There are several ways we might do this. For example, we could continually archive a knowledge base such as Wikipedia. Wikipedia is itself constantly updated, so it would document events up to the point where our society started to fail. It covers a broad range of topics, and the archive process could be automated. The archive shouldn't be located on Earth, as Earth might be partially destroyed in a singular event, and over millions of years, little will remain intact. To overcome this problem, we could locate our archive in a set of satellites that orbit the sun. This way, the archive will be easy to discover, but difficult to physically alter or destroy. We would design the satellite-based archive so that we could send automatic updates to it, but its content could not be erased. The electronics in the satellite will stop functioning shortly after we are gone, so to read the archive, a future intelligent species would have to develop the technology to travel to the archive, bring it back to Earth, and extract the data. We could use multiple satellites at different orbits for redundancy. We already possess the ability to create a satellite archive and retrieve it. Imagine if a previous intelligent species on Earth had placed a set of satellites around the solar system. We would have discovered them by now and already brought them back to Earth. In essence, we could create a time capsule designed to last for millions or hundreds of millions of years. In the distant future, intelligent beings, whether they evolve on Earth or travel from another star, could discover the time capsule and read its contents. We won't know whether our repository will be discovered or not. That's the nature of estate plans. If we do this, and it is read in the future, imagine how appreciative the recipients would be. All you have to do is think of how excited we would be to discover such a time capsule ourselves. An estate plan for humanity is similar to an estate plan for individuals. We would like our species to live forever, and maybe that will happen. But it is prudent to put in place a plan, just in case the miracle doesn't happen. I have suggested several ideas we could pursue. One is to archive our history and knowledge in a way that future intelligent species on Earth could learn about humanity, what we knew, our history, and what ultimately happened to us. Another is to create a long-lasting signal, one that tells intelligent beings elsewhere in space and time that intelligent humans once lived around the star we call the Sun. The beauty of the long-lasting signal is that it might help us in the short term by leading us to discover that other intelligent species preceded us. Is it worth the time and money to pursue initiatives like this? Would it be better to put all our efforts into improving life on Earth? There is always a friction between investing in the short term and investing in the long term. Short-term problems are more pressing, whereas investing in the future has few immediate benefits. Every organization, whether it be a government, a business, or a household, faces this dilemma. However, not investing in the long term guarantees future failure. In this case, I believe that investing in an estate plan for humanity has several near-term benefits. It will keep us more aware of the existential threats we face. It will propel more people to think about the long-term consequences of our actions as a species. And it will provide a type of purpose to our life, should we eventually fail.